Hi, it's Mark Swaywood. I'm in the Vindicator newsroom surrounded by some of the reporters who put together most of the coverage this week as we cover the last cruise at GM Lordstown. I'm with Samantha Phillips. Sam was busy on throughout the week, but especially on Wednesday, was at the diners and some of the business establishments outside of the plant. Greg Graziosi was a reporter who was embedded with the UAW throughout the week and wrote last Sunday's terrific Sunday story called The Last Days at Lordstown. And Jess Harden, and Jess was the reporter who was kind of braving the cold. It got a little windy and snowy and cold on Wednesday, and she was outside talking to workers as they exited the plant as they were finishing up their jobs in the line en route to making the last cruise. So I thought I'd start today just by talking to people about their experiences, what they experienced at the plant in the last day. And it was a pretty historic day. I mean, the Valley has had many sad passages. You look at the steel mills in the 70s and 80s, Delphi Packard, and now we're looking at the GM Lordstown, which went from 2 years ago having 4,500 workers, and now we're down to 1,500 and now down to zero. So Sam, I'm going to start with you because not physically on the plant, but you're sort of outside the plant and seeing people as they were either coming and going from the plant. What did you see, and what were some of the things that you learned when you were kind of hanging out on Wednesday?
So I went to a couple diners, and basically what I saw was that even though we've been focusing on the GM workers who, of course, went to the plant for the last time this week, there's also a lot of other businesses around the plant that will be affected by this potential closure. So I went to a couple diners. I went to a place called Ross's Food Lounge, but they weren't, they wanted to kind of maintain their privacy for the workers on that day. But the people at the diner kind of told me that they are worried about their businesses because pretty much their whole customer base are either GM workers or the workers at the, you know, the companies that supply automotive parts for them, or
and even truck drivers.
And truck drivers, that's their customer base. So they're kind of worried about the future for themselves as well. They're worried about these GM workers because they've gotten to know them, and it's almost like they're friends, and they know them by name. So I guess what I saw during my reporting was that it just created anxiety, not just for the workers and their families, but kind of for the whole village as well.
Were you there when Mayor Arnold Hill came in?
Yes.
Given all the tumult of the day, and I should point out we weren't just the only media there. Who did everybody see? What other media were out there other than the local guys, the FMJs?
At the diner, they had people from Columbus, they had people from Pittsburgh, people from Washington D.C., and they never see this much media in Lordstown. It's a small village.
Who'd you see?
I ran into people from Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, Plain Dealer, New York Times sent a video crew out. I know CNN had some people down there as well, though I didn't actually meet any of those people. And then a few radio and television stations from the Cleveland area.
Did you run into any of the international media spray?
I did not.
So in the cold, the national media was not there.
I staked out the perfect spot. Well, actually, I had taken over for Ed Runyon, our other reporter, while he went to grab some food and warm up. And there really wasn't anyone by the door we were at, though, to be fair, there are several different of those sort of revolving doors where people could enter and exit. But I had gone to that diner that Sam was at, like, just before she was there, and it was right whenever it was starting to become sort of ground zero for media in the area for people to go to, and I heard some diner-goers grumbling about, there's TV here, there's
so many cameras.
And we know Jess was at the diner because she was on WKBN.
I was.
You were last night. We have evidence of where you were because we saw you on the news last night. You were on WKBN. What was Mayor Arno like during when you ran into him?
So by the time I saw him, he had been kind of going through the motions of trying to, you know, support people and trying to comfort people all day. So by the time he got to the diner, it was already kind of a long day for him. He was up early in the morning.
You know, Ed Runyon, you mentioned Ed, met him at the, like, at 6:30, standing out front. Yeah,
exactly. And he said that, you know, Tuesday was kind of a sleepless night for him, as it probably was for most people in the village. But he was, you know, he was talking to folks who were sitting at the diner bar, and he was kind of hopeful, you know, saying, well, it's not over yet. So that was kind of the, you know, impression I got from him that day.
Yeah, that I mean, it seems like we ran into people at multiple points. You know, the we saw Mayor right at the gate. He was in there. His workers were going to the, you know, the last shift, and then off to the diner. He was on, you know, was he on the line outside at the at 2:30 at the end? Anybody see him during the protests? I saw him on the news. I saw him doing news interviews till
he late may have been the around yeah. there. I didn't see him, but there were a lot of people.
Yeah, so. There were a lot of people. So you were kind of embedded with UAW. You were the warm person.
a filthy lie. I did go out and get cold later in the day. I have video proof of it. But I was earlier in the day with the UAW.
So what was the scene like there?
Really, it was kind of similar to what Samantha was describing with it being like a ground zero for media. When I got there, there was a UAW worker, a guy named John Davies, that was rolling posters that they're going to hand out at the St. Patrick's Day parade, and he had like three cameras surrounding. He was just in this little corner with all these journalists like surrounding him, and it was because there wasn't a lot of activity at that point in the day. It was about midday when I was out there, and then there was a line of people waiting to go in and talk to Dave Green. Throughout the rest of that day, there were a few workers that had trickled in here and there, some retired folk that came by to try to, you know, see what was going on and help out as Dave was giving UAW president Dave, or UAW Local 112 president, rather, Dave Green, who was doing interviews. But not a lot of workers there, obviously, because they were at the shift, they were working. But as we got closer to about 1:30, when it was presumed that the last cruise was going to be produced, we started to see more people showing up, both from the plant and also from other organizations. Good Jobs Nation, which kind of had a little bit of a hand in pushing the rally aspect of this.
Were you getting good information about the last cruise? Because I know here, I was just here in the fine newsroom. It was kind of confusing, and I was bugging people, but lots of texts.
We didn't. The only information that I really got on the last cruise out at the UAW hall was that it was supposed to be done around 1:30-ish, and that Dave was going to leave the hall to go check on its progress. But outside of that, Nobody there had any solid leads on what was going on inside the plant. So unless they had workers inside texting them, which, I mean, I didn't.
What was the mood like, or was it just sort of like a media
at the Union Hall?
Yeah,
it was a media hub at that point. Because like I said, there weren't if workers had been there, it probably would have been a little bit different. But everybody was still working at the time, So it was a lot of us just kind of it was like a hurry up and wait. Everybody was ready to roll, but there wasn't everybody was just waiting for that 2:30 vigil to start. Yeah. Was the feeling over there?
That's right. 2:30 was the Warner Lang sort of. He's been 53 days, I think.
43 days
at the site, sort of rallying the community to not forget about the plant.
Yes.
What was the rally like? Because that was, by then it was cold, and people were sort of, you started to see a little bit more raw emotions. I think people kind of held it in check throughout the day, and then it seemed like 2:30, maybe that changed a little bit.
I would actually say it was really around 3. At 2:30, it was still primarily media out there. Yeah. There were a lot of people. Dave Green showed up right around 2:30, and when Dave showed up, that really did like lift a lot of people's spirits. And then the Good Jobs the Good Jobs Nation people brought in their singer who did the Youngstown song and all of that. But really, it was around 3 when you started to see the actual workers from the plant show up, and you saw people leaving and coming by and, you know, honking horns. There was one guy in the back of a pickup truck with a giant UAW flag that stood up. I tried to get a picture of him, but I couldn't. you know, when that started, that was when you started to see a lot of the emotion come out because people were there with their friends, their workers.
And literally, he was in the street on the Bill Lewis video on Vinny.com. One of the people you guys were talking to, someone actually pulls him out of the street.
Oh, yeah.
Because cars and trucks were coming.
Mark Franco is a 28-year GM veteran who is, he's 2 years away from his 30. So he was out there with a big American flag waving it. But yeah, I mean, we had poured out into the streets. At one point, the rally goers actually shut down the streets for a period of about two and a half minutes, just like chanting UAW, holding UAW banners, waving American flags, things like that, holding up their signs.
Was there a police or security presence?
No, there really wasn't.
is why people were being pulled out of the streets.
Yeah, I can't speculate on why there weren't, but I mean, it was noted that there was really a lack of police out there. I've been in other situations during my time as a reporter where streets have gotten shut down and things have gotten bad, but the UAW people, they went out, they shut down for a few minutes, the motorists didn't even seem mad, and then they moved back after a few minutes. Like, they weren't out, in my perspective, they weren't looking to cause chaos. They wanted to go out, do their thing, rally, and then they, you know, went back to the sidelines and let motorists pass. So,
Jess, what did, when you were by the revolving doors and watching people leave, what were sort of some of the experience? You wrote about one guy who seemed upset. It's in the Vindicator today.
So I guess about half of the people were interested in speaking with me, and the other half were probably a little bit more angry about their final moments at the plant. One guy, I asked if he was interested in talking to me, and he kind of like opened his car door and slammed it and yelled out the window that he can't wait to get out of this hellhole. And that was just after I had heard someone say, we were sad, but like we managed to keep positive. And so there were definitely
range
that
of
like
emotions.
Really encapsulated the mixed emotions of people walking out. Because of the fact that folks were working on the crews in, you know, different parts of the crews, as it was being finished, people kind of dribbled out slowly, and they were carrying, you know, lunch boxes, boxes of their belongings. It was like, you know, like a mass firing, you know, people just carrying their belongings in boxes. And one of the things that struck me was a retiree named Ed Randall was standing outside the door that I was kind of parked by, and he was just greeting everyone that walked outside. He, you know, shook their hands. I guess he had retired in July, and I was able to talk to him afterwards, and he said, you know, I just wanted to send well wishes to my coworkers. And he was an older man. He had worked there for 30 years, and the wind chill was 8 degrees. So, you know, he really braved the cold to show solidarity with people, which I thought was really interesting. And everyone that I talked to, like, despite being sad or angry, seemed pretty hopeful, and they are sticking it out until negotiations in the fall.
So, yeah, so which brings us to where does it go now? So what? So we've covered, you know, since November when the announcement was that it was going to be an unallocated plant, whatever the heck that means. We've been preparing for this moment. The moment has happened. So I guess it leads us to what's next. So what type of hope is there for the future of GM Lordstown?
You want me to field that one?
You can. Whoever wants to jump in.
Okay. I can take it. If you guys have anything to add, you can jump in.
Yeah, sure. I'll add mine after yours. Go ahead.
Okay, sure. So essentially, what Dave Green has said over and over again is that he believes that their fate is in the hands of the International Union. So when they bargained this September, you know, he's confident when you talk to Green that the union is going to look out for Lordstown when they are at the bargaining table. He said that Rich Rankin, who's the director of the union of the district that GM Lordstown falls under, has visited there. This is Lordstown or Youngstown was actually Rankin's like home district. So he's confident that they'll have that representation. Other than that, I mean, there's all kinds of gambits that people can come up with on like what could actually save the Lordstown plant. But right now, the absolute best is that the union manages to negotiate a new product allocation at that site. Outside of that, what would happen at Lordstown really is anybody's guess. My assumption would be at some point, GM would probably try to sell the plant rather than just leave it sit there because they still have to pay, even if they readjust, you know, their tax valuation on that property, they still have to pay some amount of taxes on that property, and, you know,
they still keep some lights on and some energy costs.
Exactly. Yeah. So at some point, they're probably going to want to sell that.
And right now, what's the staffing out there?
Staffing out there, for the next several weeks, they'll actually have quite a few people still working out there because they're producing replacement parts.
Bob Yose is reporting he counted 80 cars in the parking
lot
today.
So they'll still have at least some semblance of a crew out there producing what are called SPO parts, which are just replacement parts for the cruises. After that production line is finished, there will probably be 20 to 30 people just for a facility of that size in there, keeping the temperature up, making sure the water lines don't freeze and break, making sure, you know, there's no, like things don't crack, keeping the building maintained. Because technically, in its unallocated status, whatever that means, the it has to remain in a ready state so that at a moment's notice, you know, they could reallocate a product there and start production again. If they were to just let that go to close, I think GM would have a very hard time in its lawsuit that the UAW is levied against it, arguing that they haven't closed that plant.
Right, right.
So at very least until September, they need to at least keep up appearances that that plant can be reopened at any time, which requires, you know, a regular round-the-clock crew.
So, yeah, so security and what
security, happened. Yeah, security, maintenance workers, things like that.
Seems like that would be a pretty sweet gig. Am I right?
Chilling in a giant plant.
Yeah, hang out in a giant plant where you have very little oversight and not much to do.
I can't imagine it's very warm in there, though.
Probably not very warm.
Cold. Just add on to that, you know, and I spoke to one woman yesterday named Jackie who put it pretty well. She said that it's the worst poker game. You don't know if you should put, you know, all in and just get up and move, or if you just, you know, stay put, wait to see what cards you have. And it's just,
because even September is what, six months away.
Yeah, I mean, yeah,
if you are a family, and obviously I was talking earlier to some other folks, you know, right now what you're starting to see in the workforce are the second shift people who are now finding, you know, they have to go get jobs, or they have, you know, they're worried about unemployment, they're worried about health care benefits and all that. So you're starting to see them move into the job market. So there'll be some time before some of the final shift people end up, but it's not 6 months.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Everyone I talked to was basically saying that they were kind of biding their time until September. And, you know, one woman said she has, like, a side business that she's going to be focusing on. One guy said that he was going to help his friend who owns a comic book shop put things on eBay for him, like do listings like that. And so people, I think, are trying to find some like odds and ends
jobs. Odds and ends to keep for 6 months.
And then I spoke to some folks about the prospect of transferring and what that's looked like. And
some heartbreaking stories we ran into with people who are weekend parents now.
Right, definitely. Absolutely. Yeah.
What were some of those stories? What did we hear about people who were traversing back and forth?
So I talked to a guy named Gary Hilton who said he had 5 years left until he hits retirement, and he said that he's going to wait until to see if anything happens, but if it comes to it, he will take a transfer and leave his family here because his kids are in school in, I think, North Jackson, and, you know, it's not something that he wants to uproot. Whereas someone else I talked to, Jason Markovich, he said, you know, I'm a single dad, I can't go. You know, my elderly dad is here.
His was heartbreaking. His was heartbreaking.
Yeah, yeah. He recently buried his mom, and he said, you know, I don't want to leave her either. So,
I mean, I didn't have any specific people that I was talking to. I mean, Mark Franco that I talked to, the guy with the flag, he is 2 years out. He's looking, he wants to stay here, obviously, but he also wants to get to his 30. So he told me he would take a transfer if need be. But the gentleman I talked to for my Sunday piece last week, he told me that he had tons of friends who were, you know, out, had moved to Flint or to Spring Hill or...
Yeah, that Sunday story seems so far away. And it was just
it was just
Sunday, and say it's only...
But he had told me that there's tons of people that he's been talking to who've had to, you know, basically just leave their families behind. So he's going to stay here. Because of exactly what Jess had said, he didn't want to uproot his family. He's got kids that are in athletics at Canfield High School. You know, all of his family and friends are here. So for him, it's just, you know, it's not worth it to chase the company around the country, you know, but lose his family. So.
And I talked to I talked to somebody who, the story didn't make it for the big issue yesterday, but he said that he's involved with City Kids Care in Youngstown. And it's almost as if, you know, he has to choose between not only his family, but something, you know, this initiative that he's worked so hard on. You know, he doesn't want to turn his back to his community. He wants to keep working and trying to make it better. And, you know, to throw all that away to, like he said, chase the company, it's just not feasible, and it's not feasible for many people.
What were extraordinary, if there were any, journalistic experiences? I mean, you know, here we are, you know, newspaper in the 21st century. So obviously there's a newspaper that came out today and it's chock-a-block full of stories and pictures and charts and graphics. And we cover everything from retirees to the workforce there. I mean, we even found a guy who was in a picture of the 400,000th produced Impala back in 1969. He drove in the car as a kid, and we tracked him down as an adult today. So journalistically, you know, for the paper, there's a lot to do. But also on Vindy.com, there is Twitter, and there's Vindy.com, and there's pictures, and there's video. As a journalist, what were some of the experiences like?
I don't know. I think it's one good thing about this media landscape we have today is the fact that, you know, everyone has this in their hands at all times. So instead of, you know, having nothing on our website all day long, we have the ability to kind of document things as we go. And I know for you guys, you're getting fed all this information from different perspectives rather than just sitting in the dark for 10 hours. I wonder what they're reporting on. I wonder what's going on. You know, it's nice to be able to communicate in that way and to...
Did you get enough text from me to do your job?
Definitely.
Oh, good. I was worried about that. Whether
and to not have like a blank website all day was nice. Being able to like feed information and show people, okay, well, this is happening at the rally and this is what's happening at the vigil. And I thought that was really cool.
Yeah. We were able to check some things in real time too, which was good too. The whole thing on the last cruise, you know, people were sending pictures saying, this is the start, I think, last Thursday or Friday. This is the last cruise.
Yeah.
Well, when you checked into that, it was like, well, this is the last cruise that your part of the line is going to work on. That doesn't mean, you know, it's going to be the last cruise that comes out the door. And so part of what we're doing back here is trying to fact check which is the last cruise.
It was helpful. I think I found some folks on the internet, like, prior to going out there on Wednesday, and I just like tossed some Facebook messages into the void, and that was one of the ways that I got connected with people, is that like people are posting about it, they're using hashtags, they're, you know, like a lot of people were posting about like their picture.
Did you run
of the
into people
cruise.
That you fought at the gate that you had reached out to, or just people?
I didn't, but I did get to meet up with someone that I had reached out to, and so that was very helpful. And you know, like as a journalist, it was cool to be able to kind of make those connections and you know see people in that way and be able to include some of aspects of their story as well.
And this was less for you than a, you know, kind of a one day, because you had spent significant period of the last couple of weeks building up to this. So what were the journalistic experiences you?
I mean, that aspect of it where I had been following this, you know, for the better part of 2 weeks at that point, just being out there and just seeing all of this kind of culminate was certainly, you know, interesting. But I mean, anytime you've got a situation with a rally, like we had out on at the vigil, is always there's a few times in my career where I've had, you know, the kinds of experiences that you have out there when you've got that spontaneous mass of humanity,
right,
all, you know, behind whatever concept has brought them all together, whatever issue, just kind of spontaneously breaking out and just seeing like the explosion of raw emotion and conviction and things like that. Those are really exciting times for me as a journalist.
'Cause it's authentic.
It is. It's authentic, and it's also rare, you know, especially in our field where so often we're dealing with PR people or we're dealing with corporate people or we're dealing with politicians who are trying to tightly manage their information, to see just like a very authentic and real output from people, you know, is nice, and it's a change.
And that was my excitement about putting like 8 people out the door and saying, okay, you know, find the story, because and for veteran people, a lot of the veterans kind of stepped up in ways I couldn't imagine, and then a lot of the people who are younger in the field, you guys, who get a lot of, you know, well, except for Greg, but who get a lot of you know, phone interviews and email interviews and press releases. You know, sometimes there's nothing better in journalism sometimes. And I say this as a guy who sits behind a desk all day, then getting your feet, you know, out into the field and running into journalism instead of responding to it. Sometimes it's best to kind of be out there, and the sum total of the experience is really the story. And you know, I think that's kind of what made yesterday, literally, from, I think Ed was waking me up at 6 o'clock in the morning yesterday morning to post things till we closed out editing the last story around, you know, 9. I mean, it was a full kind of 360 experience. I mean, we had, everyone was involved, everyone contributed, everyone did a great job. And I think, you know, it's sad for the valleys, you know, it's sad that we're getting so good at things, covering things closing. I think, you know, it's not really something I think as a community you want to refine your skills at. But I think that have the experience of having people out in the field and connecting with the people and connecting with people involved and making so many good stories out of them and helping tell their story. I think that's really an important part of what we do. And sometimes, you know, in our state, we don't do that as often as we could. So,
yeah, it's really cool to go out there and give these people a voice. You know, I mean, and this is the kind of thing I obviously feel terribly for these people. And it was horrible yesterday seeing what people were going through, but there's just something about going out, talking to people, seeing these things happen in person, you know, such a historic day and being able to give these people a voice and just really being able to explore how it's really going to affect everyday people, you know, because when you read about these things in the newspaper, if you're reading about it in the perspective of, okay, this company is going to close down, you know, over 1,000 people lose their jobs, you know, I think that hits you differently than when you talk to somebody like Jess did, for example, saying, well, I have to move away now and I'm not going to see my family during the week and it's really hard. I think those individual experiences was just really special to capture and kind of immortalize in print.
And some of your work, Bob Yose and Bill Lewis did a great job in photography and video too, but some of the images I think that sort of last with me, the one of the shoes in front of the main door where the workers left their shoes is sort of a testament that, hey, you know, this is really human beings this is affecting, that we're right. Humans and this is affecting us. That was good. Jess's description of people rolling out their personal effects, that to me is sort of the you know, the diner perspective and, oh, you know, this is our business and what's going to happen now, because so much of what we do here is reliant not only on workers but people passing through the area and all that. That was a huge thing. And then, you know, and Greg sending, you know, the dispatches from the middle of the rally. We're finally after you know, because drive at home, Ohio is kind of a controlled, you know, environment. There's public relations involved with that. I think the union has worked very hard to maintain a level. And the company, obviously GM stopped talking to us a long time ago. And what they did was mostly, you know, PR, let's use a polite term. But the, you know, that moment where people, finally this has happened and finally people get to react Raleigh, those are some of, in my brain, sort of embedded images from, you know, the coverage of the day. What are your images? Different than mine? Have I used up all the good ones?
I was more so, I think because I was involved with the surrounding businesses. I mean, if you guys want to share the images you saw, you know, I wasn't really at the rally or the vigil, but if you guys want to describe yours.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was definitely when they shut down the street, you know.
Yeah.
Just, and not even just that when you have a group that shuts down the street, that's always kind of like a tense moment because you're like, oh, what's going to happen? But more so during that, it was, you know, seeing all these people, you know, shut it down, have their UAW flags out, chanting, you know, UAW. Like, there's not a lot of unions anymore. Not like that. I mean, there are a lot of unions, but there's not with that amount of, I guess, conviction for the cause of labor. And maybe that's coming back a little bit, but that's not something that I've really ever seen up close and personal. And I mean, that stuck with me. It was, you know, kind of knowing what these guys have gone through and what was going on and the fight that they have ahead of them, you know, that was really, like, impactful.
Yeah, and I think that, I don't know, some of the more minor human aspects of the story, like the fact that people are leaving friends behind, the fact that people, you know, have worked alongside folks for 10, 20, 30 years, and they're not going to be doing that anymore.
Yeah, Ed Runyon had the two buddies who were leaving at the same time. The video, I think it was on video.com too, where they're like, yeah, we're just not going to see each other.
We're just going to part ways. Yeah, and there were a few people, you know, someone drove by and, like, waved out, you know, said, I love you, like, aww, I love you too, you know, just like, those sort of moments definitely stuck with me. And there were, like, two friends that walked out together. And, you know, they were just like, we were just crying in there. And, you know, stuff like that. Just the interactions that I saw in the parking lot, I think, where people were, like, literally just, like, taking their work glasses off and getting to their car. And it was just, like, felt like a very authentic series of moments.
Mm-hmm. Well, we promised not to go on for more than a half hour. Final thoughts around the table real quickly, Sam?
One thing to add on, I think that one of the most powerful things I saw was the fact that, you know, Jess had a really great picture yesterday of the General Motors sign that it said, save us, a little handwritten sign. And I just thought, you know, driving around Lordstown yesterday, you saw all these signs that said, save us, help us, please, bring something. And there is definitely a buzz in the air. So I think that the people of Lordstown for right now are kind of on hold. But, you know, I think we're all rooting for them and hoping that, you know, either there's going to be a new product or that something will happen to give these people a sense of stability that they once had.
It's a good one.
Yeah, I mean, final thought would just be that, you know, the story is far from over. And I think that's, you know, something that a lot of the people out there are very aware of is that right now there's a lot of attention. But a lot of that attention is going to leave now that the big, you know, climax at this part of the story has ended. Obviously, we'll still be out there covering it, but there's still a lot more to happen. What's going to happen in September, you know, and then what happens after that if they don't allocate a product?
Right.
You know, the sale of that, what happens to Lordstown, what happens to their tax base. So there's a lot more there, and this is really just kind of like the starting pistol to a much longer story.
I think in one of the classes I teach, it was always one of my favorite phrases. It's not the... an ending isn't the ending, it's actually the beginning of another story. And this really is sort of what happens next. The ending of the plan is that thing, but now it's the beginning of the what's next issue.
Right.
I think that one of the things that struck me was a lot of people referred to their 30 years when they're able to retire. And most of the people I talked to started working here when they were teenagers. And so their 30 years is them at mid 40s, 50s, like they're still very young. And I think that that is something
God bless
that...
you. that's a really good observation.
But we're not, we're not talking about like 75-year-old
people.
People
in their 50s are very young. By that standard.
Yeah. Right, but like the guy I was talking to was 41 or 43, and he's like, well, I have 5 years left. And it's like, oh my God. Like, he's 43. And, you know, one of the things he said is, you know, I have 5 years until I reach 30 years and I'm not ready yet. Like, I'm not ready to be done. I wasn't planning on stopping then. You know, you have people that are, you know, able-bodied adults and, you know, are just like what are they going to do? Like, they're, it really, like, that struck me. And I think that a lot of people are just like truly at a loss and they have decades to provide for their families and, you know, to continue to live their lives.
Right.
And we'll continue to live our lives here at the Vindicator. And these are the big part of the coverage team that put together all of our coverage on the closing of the GM Lordstown plant. It's Sam Phillips and Greg Graziosi and Jess Harden. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks.
That's all from the Vindicator Newsroom.